Okay. We left off looking at the majority opinion in Helling versus Carey, which had this kind of startling assertion of authority by the Supreme Court that it, rather than the profession of ophthalmology, should set the standard of when to use this glaucoma test. And while we're at it, it's actually a fairly good illustration. I think the court used a sort of learned hand analysis here, not only relying on T.J. Hooper, but a sort of this calculus. What do we know about glaucoma? What is the chance at the age of, below the age of 40 that a person has undisclosed glaucoma? Okay. So if that's the case, or if you did this in terms of probabilities, the probability is, I don't know if I've got the right number of zeros here, 0.00004, that's the probability. Now we need the burden compared to the probability times the magnitude of harm. Magnitude of harm, at least I've lost here. Let's look at the burden for a moment. That might be a number we could more easily arrive at.
Well, it's very small, I think.
Give me a number.
Yeah.
What does it cost the ophthalmologist to do a glaucoma test for people under the age of 40?
$10.
You already have the equipment.
Nothing.
Well, time's valuable, but
fix that thing. You can use it over and over.
$10 might. I would. Give me $5. You've got a staff out there that's going to be doing this stuff. You've all done it, at least.
You can bill them for it. So, you do the test.
But that's still a cost to somebody. Then they turn around and, so forth. Okay, so if it's $5 to give the test, and even if it's $10, we can still run the numbers, but this just gives you an idea here. What kind of magnitude of a loss do we have to have in order for this test to be worth it? What's that? To be worth giving, where the burden is less than the probability times the magnitude of a loss, but just the math, the way I should have left it as 1 in 25,000, because so long as the loss of eyesight is greater than $125,000, and that seems like a fairly modest assessment of what you would expect by way of compensation for having your vision reduced to this 5% angle of vision. Isn't that what she's left with? To be able to go through, that's all that she can see, is this 5% field of view. So if this is more than $125,000, then the burden is, and again, if you said the burden was $10, then this would rise to $250,000. But that's your break-even point. A reasonable person who can, for $5, avoid a 1 in 25,000 chance of a $125,000 loss, a reasonable person will expend that money. Now, again, part of the question is who's making this call? And initially, the jury wasn't even given an opportunity to consider it. So when the Supreme Court says, in effect, we think that learned hands principle in the T.J. Hooper case, the courts in the end must say what is what's reasonable, that applies to this case as well as it does to tugboats. If that's the Supreme Court's determination, what would they ordinarily do? Send it back to the jury, you'd think. What do they do?
Well,
that was the trial court, but then the plaintiff appeals that, Supreme Court agrees, yeah, the wrong standard was applied, but instead of returning it to the jury to have the jury sit as the, you know, ophthalmology professions review board, instead, what does the court say?
The court of appeals affirmed. I'm sorry, I don't know specifically.
Well, now the Supreme Court says we reverse, oh, right. And did Mr. Kendall?
I think he says that they called for a new trial, but only on the issue of damages.
Yeah, liability's in the bag now. As a matter of law. Now, how can you do that as a matter of law? Because no reasonable person could disagree with this proposition. So we've gone from deference to the profession at the trial court level, so long as the physician complies with the standards established by the medical profession, that is reasonable care, to one where the jury has the freedom to set aside the professional standards and substitute ones that are of their own liking, to the point now where the Supreme Court said, oh, and by the way, no reasonable person could be doing what the profession of ophthalmology has been doing. As a matter of law, that's negligent. So it's kind of bracing, to say the least, the way this case finally turns out. But again, that's the majority opinion, and I want to highlight the difference between the majority opinion and the concurring opinion, and you'll see the relevance here of our discussion of strict liability. What does the concurring opinion say?
Well, Justice Butter obviously especially concurred and citing the rule of strict liability.
Okay. And what's the difference in applying the rule of strict liability?
First part of this, I mean, just as greater duty of care could be imposed on the defendants than the, you know, established by the profession. The plaintiff shouldn't have to bear the loss.
So, what the concurring opinion says is we still want to impose liability, but not on the basis that the majority did. We want to do it on the basis of strict liability, which doesn't require a finding of negligence. Why does the concurring opinion want to do that? Why does it make a difference? I mean, from the defendant's standpoint, they're still reaching into the defendant's wallet and pulling the money out of the wallet.
Don't they want to shift their cost to insurance?
But that's accomplished by the majority's approach, Ms. Reed.
They don't
want to hurt the poor doctor's feelings. That the finding of negligence carries sort of a stigma of moral blame, whereas a finding of strict liability says we're not saying you were negligent, we're not actually criticizing what you're doing, we simply think that as a matter of public policy it is better that you pay compared to the plaintiff. Now, again, if you're a doctor reading this, or anybody else for that matter, reading this opinion, trying to get a sense of where the court is going, what to expect in the future, the majority's just told you that as a doctor you can't rely on the standards of your profession. You ultimately will be answerable to a jury, and for that matter to the Supreme Court of Washington into what they think is the proper practice of medicine. But now you have this concurring opinion, and for the moment it's only, how many of these guys are there? Two who joined the, how many joined this concurring opinion? Yeah, just, wait a second. Utter's writing the opinion, Finley and Hamilton concur. So three out of the nine at the moment want to go this different way. And obviously, if it's, you know, University of Michigan affirmative action, you got a 5-4 split, you got, you know, you're teetering on the edge of all sorts of different possibilities depending on what the membership of the court is. Where it's 6-3, we still have a pretty healthy balance in favor of the majority opinion, but here's the concurring opinion. Let's see if I can understand. Suppose there were five people on the court who thought the way the concurring opinion is written. What would be the new principle under which I, as someone practicing medicine, on what basis could I anticipate in the future I would be required to pay for injuries suffered by my patients? Okay. And which of the injuries suffered by my patients would I have to pay for? You mean, I'm an ophthalmologist, a patient comes into me, has eye problems, I've been referred by some general practitioner, I look and I say, gee, I'm terribly sorry, the reason you're having problems with your eyes is you have a brain tumor. And she dies of a brain tumor, and then her estate sues me and says, I'm sorry, you're strictly liable. We want to be compensated for the loss suffered when she died of a brain tumor. According to Justice Utter, you're strictly liable.
I mean, obviously for the injuries that you could have foreseen or prevented.
But wait a minute, if the basis for imposing liability is that I should have foreseen and prevented them, are we not using the language of the majority? That this really, despite the language to the contrary, what we're really doing is imposing a standard of negligence. Negligence, after all, looks to whether or not you met the standard of reasonable care. If you did meet the standard of reasonable care, you're not liable. If you didn't meet the standard of care, then you, and of course we fought in the majority over who sets that standard, the jury, the profession, but it is a standard of reasonable care. I thought in the concurring opinion that we were identifying a different standard. What is the basis for the concurring opinion if it's not negligence? What is it that makes it right for us to impose liability on the doctor? Here?
Yeah. It's the simple, inexpensive nature of the test.
Okay.
There shouldn't be such a well-defined line as to when you do or do not administer the test. It can be standard procedure, so it should.
Well, but the language of what they should have done, that they didn't do what they should have done, still sounds to me like a negligence theory. I'm sorry to be so dense here. Ms. DeRocher?
Well, I think that one case you're talking about, I think the brain tumor was wrong, the scope of neurology and jury could reasonably say that neurology, ophthalmology, okay, is that strict liability? No, it's probably negligent. If you even want to go there.
Oh, okay, but
medical malpractice is something that maybe a jury isn't equipped to deal with. So the issue of liability.
But why are we imposing the liability on the doctors, though?
What's they have
insurance. Okay, so what the concurring opinion could be saying is the new standard will be, we'll invite the jury to your offices. The jury will look down in the parking lot and compare your car to the plaintiff's car. And if you've got a shinier car, doctor, I have very bad news for you. You're going to have to pay for this because you're in a better position to pay. Now, that could be the rule. I don't think that's what they really meant to say. But there's a hint in this opinion that the reason for imposing liability doesn't have to do with fault. But it also doesn't seem plausible that every bad thing that happened, you know, if you're an oncologist, so that you treat people with cancer and you get patients, some of whom you're able to treat and they are cured and they're, you know, they go home healthy again, but a substantial number of your patients, you can't do anything other than maybe postpone it or give them some palliative care and they die. It just seems inconceivable that you would say that you are strictly liable for all your failures, even though we find nothing wrong with the care that you provided. And yet that seems to be, in essence, what happens here. She's got glaucoma. He fails to treat her. You could say that he was negligent in failing to do that. Then you're going along the majority's way of thinking. But if you're really talking strict liability, you say there's something about what you're doing that makes it appropriate that you pay for it, even though we can't find fault with what you're doing. Now, the only way it seems to me you could kind of thread the needle here is to say what the concurring opinion is talking about is maybe like holding the ophthalmology profession at fault. You know, we're not like Hester Prynne, who gets the scarlet letter A on her dress. We're not going to paint an N for negligent on the individual doctor. We're going to hang that on the ophthalmology board that came up with this stupid rule. But it's still, we're taking the focus away from the individual doctor. He shouldn't feel responsible, but it's the board as a whole. Maybe that's what they're really talking about, but if so, they're being awfully confusing by bringing up this idea of strict liability. If you're going to talk about strict liability, you should be able to articulate what is the mechanism, what's the category that you fall into that triggers strict liability. What is it that you're doing other than having a shinier car? Surely that can't be the standard for liability. And the only thing we can think of is that it's sort of a negligence test without the harshness of the negligence label. That's about all you can come up with. Now, again, my purpose in introducing this case is to make us think more carefully about the distinction between a standard based on whether somebody uses reasonable care, which is what we've been doing up till now. Every time we look at somebody's behavior, we're creating this benchmark. Here's what a reasonable person would have done, and then we line up the defendant's conduct and say, did it meet or not meet that standard? That's the coin of the realm. That's the name of the game. Whereas when you move into strict liability, you're saying there's some policy reason we have for saying it's not necessary for the plaintiff to establish negligence. The plaintiff deserves to recover because of something. The defendant's activity falls within some category where we say to the defendant, when you do this, you do it at your peril. If bad things happen, you can be held liable even if you're not at fault. When we get to the end of the chapter, we talk about liability for people who have dogs and dogs who bite somebody. And you can, as a matter of statute or ordinance or otherwise, have a leash law or something. It says basically it's your job to keep your dog under control. If your dog goes off and bites somebody, you have to pay the damages. And you don't have to prove that the owner of the dog was negligent. You simply have to prove the owner's dog bit somebody. And you can say, in a sense, we love dogs, but people who own them and keep them at their peril. What's, again, puzzling about Helling versus Carey is that the court never articulates, not the court, the concurring opinion, who offers this alternative theory, never articulates what the standard would be. I understand when I buy a dog and keep a dog, I keep the dog at my peril. What is it that I'm doing in practicing medicine that the concurring opinion suggests would trigger strict liability? Don't know. It can't be complete strict liability. All injuries that your patients suffer, that would be stupid. Blaming doctors because people die of cancer? It could be that we'll only make you pay where you're richer than the plaintiff, but that wouldn't last very long because the doctors wouldn't be rich very long. Probably wouldn't even practice medicine very long. Some of them are complaining even now under a rule of negligence that they can't afford to practice medicine. But at least that standard we understand, whereas the strict liability standard in that context really doesn't make any sense. Mr. Bovet?
Is it what they say that standard of reasonable prudence specialist
reasonable protection. Isn't that a negligence standard all over again? The reason, and again, the doctors would take some comfort in that and say, so long as we're practicing reasonable medicine, of course we've gotten the bad news that we're no longer free to set that standard ourselves. We're now answerable to the Supreme Court of Ophthalmology to tell us what they're going to accept and reject in the standards that we have set. But at least it's a standard of what a reasonable person would do. They're only going to find us liable if we fail to do something a reasonable person would do. So, in that respect, it seems to me the concurrence does us no favor by addressing this as though it were strict liability. Because strict liability doesn't care about whether the behavior was reasonable or not. You may have made all sorts of reasonable decisions in buying this dog, in training the dog, in keeping the dog, and through no fault of yours, that dog got out and bit somebody. Tough luck, you pay. And if you don't like them apples, don't buy a dog. That could be an intelligent public policy decision. The public policy could be to say, oh, that's not fair. So long as people are using reasonable care, they're not responsible for what their dog does, unless the jury finds that they acted negligently. That could also be a public policy decision, because you like dogs and you don't want people to be inhibited from buying the dogs they love. But you could also, as a matter of public policy, say, as much as we love dogs, people shouldn't impose the burden, the risk of a dog, on someone, some innocent person. Mr. Bradford?
The case that we read earlier about the driver who has the seizure problem and takes medication, could they not have found him liable?
You could.
For crashing in there rather than...
You could find him strictly liable. In effect, that's what the plaintiff wanted to do. The plaintiff said, we think as a matter of public policy, people with medical conditions who put other people at risk should, in effect, be held strictly liable for imposing that risk on the rest of us. And you remember the court's answer to that invitation was, go down the street. If there's going to be a change in the law along those lines, it should come from the legislature, not from the courts.
But in this case, the court said, we'll make the policy measure.
Yes.
That's like a conflict of interest.
Well,
as
I said at the time, you will see the court go back and forth. You will see the court at times saying, you came to the wrong building. This is not our function. We're just judges, after all. On other days, on other issues, they will say, you know, it's a solemn responsibility, and we have to do this. So, again, one of the ongoing issues is exactly what is a judge to do when there are important public policy questions about which the judge himself or herself has opinions about what's good or bad public policy, but at the same time I'm faced with something like a statute or a precedent or a constitutional text or previous constitutional precedent, and I as a judge have to make a determination, am I bound, you know, what am I bound by? My perception of what society needs at this moment? What's good public policy? Am I bound by what the text of the Constitution says? By what some previous precedent says? You know, et cetera, et cetera. And we're all kind of at sea about that. We're not quite sure what a judge is supposed to be doing and when we want them boldly, you know, swashbuckling into the future, and when we want them to just sit down and do their job. Depending on your issue, as it turns out, we think, oh, well, on that one, there's supposed to be more than a potted plant. On that one, they're getting a little too big for their britches. Yeah?
So would this case be an example of the court trying to establish a new standard for the profession to follow?
There isn't as clear a precedent on this one. There is a I think the precedent of deference to the profession for professional standards is one which they set aside. I do think that they were being a little frisky here, shall we say. Even more so, as it turns out in the next case, are they being frisky. But I guess in addition to the issue of their prior precedent, one of the things I would say in defense of a state Supreme Court is that most of the decisions of a state Supreme Court with respect to interpreting prior precedent and establishing the rules for tort liability, let's say, the legislature, by a majority vote, can simply pass a statute that fixes whatever mistake they've made. The legislature at the next session could come back and say, no, in the future, the standard for what is acceptable medical care is going to be set by the medical profession, not by people in black robes who, you know, what's the difference between a judge and God? You know, God doesn't think he's a judge. you know, if that's the legislature can cure that kind of mistake, whereas, you know, mistakes, for example, interpreting the rules on affirmative action, you know, whichever way you think that case should have gone, you can't easily fix that mistake, whichever mistake it was, by having Congress pass a statute next week. You either have to amend the Constitution, or you fight like crazy the next time Supreme Court justices are up for nomination, or up for confirmation. Okay, well, let's, again, back on the issue of the difference between strict liability and negligence. Again, strict liability doesn't require a finding of negligence, a lack of reasonable care. The defendant may establish to our satisfaction that what they did was reasonable. Again, contrast this with the res ipsa situation. Res ipsa simply creates the inference of negligence, but the defendant is always free to persuade you that on these facts, that what the defendant did was actually reasonable. Whereas in a strict liability case, if strict liability applies, reasonable care is no longer the coin of the realm. It's simply a question, did the plaintiff establish the prerequisites for this version of strict liability? And as we will see, there are different places where strict liability has been established. And one of the interesting questions is finding that line. Where is it that we identify the dividing line between when my activity is subject to strict liability and when it's not? If I own a cat, for example, and there's no statute making, you know, a leash law for cats, I'm not strictly liable if my cat goes and, you know, bites somebody or claws them or whatever. It just applies to dogs. So, again, figuring out where the line is drawn can be tricky. So let's talk about, one more here. Okay, you're on to something there. We're going to have to postpone the resolution of that, but let me just say, to be a troublemaker in response to that when you get in your car in the morning and propel, you know, 2,500 pounds of steel and, you know, vinyl and whatever it is, aluminum, down the highway, It fits your description. It's a dangerous activity that puts people at risk, and even if you're using the utmost reasonable care, some accidents do happen. Should you be strictly liable for that? I would say no. Society says no, but why we make that subject to strict liability, whereas as in Sigler versus Kuhlman, the people who drive 10,000 gallons of gasoline around, we say you are subject to strict liability. Well, what's the difference?
All
Right. It's not me. Yeah. and it's actually not, that's a very sensible distinction. Oh, but let's hold that thought, very good thought. Let's hold it and put the facts of Sigler versus Kuhlman on the table and the law that goes with it. It's this, in one sense, somewhat redeems our impression of the Washington Supreme Court. In other respects, we're still wondering, but that's so it goes. Let's see. Mr. Bradford, why don't you tell us about Sigler versus Kuhlman?
Well, the plaintiff was or someone representing her, was a 7-year-old that died in a gasoline explosion when her car encountered a pool of gasoline. Slight impact with some object of muffled explosion and then searing flames and gasoline poured from an overturned trailer tank close to her car. The defendant was the company responsible for the transportation of the tanker and presented evidence that it met the industry standards, such as the use of correct equipment, the equipment was in proper working condition, properly attached to the truck, it met the ICC standards, spring.
Okay, and very good, but at this point we have a good little review, again, of the chapter one, the earlier issues we had. How does the plaintiff go about establishing negligence? By contrast, how does the defendant go about persuading us that they used reasonable care? And again, one of the things the defendant pointed to was industry custom. Look how industry custom supports the reasonableness of the steps that I took. What was the plaintiff's major point of attack?
Well, the defendant was, as we stated, is involved in a really dangerous activity.
We get there, but when the case was presented at trial, the plaintiff's initial strategy was, how do I make the defendant liable? Yeah, by way of a res ipsa theory.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, that all the evidence was destroyed in the explosion, and that, we can infer that it wouldn't have happened had they not been doing something negligent.
So the case goes to the jury on a res ipsa theory, and what does the jury say?
The jury verdict was for the defendant, the plaintiff appeals, the court of
And just to slow down there, what is the basis for the plaintiff's appeal?
Contributory negligence, that the plaintiff was speeding and that was...
But that's not the plaintiff's argument on appeal. The defendant's going to make that pitch. That's sort of, it's another little side avenue. But again, if the plaintiff's going to get a new trial out of this, the plaintiff's got to show something went wrong at the trial level. And the plaintiff's argument that what went wrong at the trial level revolves around the instructions on res ipsa, it turns out. It's sort of a minor point here because the court takes a completely different view of the case. And whether they should or not is another story. But again, the plaintiff's theory of this case is it's all about negligence. And they want to use res ipsa to establish negligence. It sounds like a classic res ipsa case. Alas, the jury didn't see it that way. The jury ruled against the plaintiff. And the plaintiff's trying to get a new trial based upon an error in the instructions on res ipsa. That's the way the case gets submitted to the Supreme Court. But once it gets to the Supreme Court, what's the Supreme Court's pleasure with the case? What do they want to do with it?
What do they want to just to determine damages.
Well, how do they get to the liability? I mean, what's how do they get there?
They say that the defendant was engaged, under strict liability. The first thing we talked about.
Okay. So the reason the way they get there is because this isn't about negligence. It's a strict liability case. Now, by itself, that provokes a dissenting opinion. What's Justice Neal's dissenting opinion? What's the thrust of that? Mr. Lobach?
Basically, he says for procedural issues, this is made appeal to others on the grounds of race. And so we shouldn't even be discussing.
If the plaintiff had argued strict liability at trial and had been turned down, and if they were coming to this court saying a strict liability theory should have been imposed, fine, let's talk about strict liability, but who are we to essentially, you know, you show up for the World Series, you know, and suddenly there are goalposts and, you know, this pigskin, and well, wait a minute, it's a different game that we're playing. So now I came here prepared to talk about, if the defendant says we tried this on the basis of res ipsa, basis of negligence, what is the court doing suddenly? I can't disagree with the law you're applying, but the procedural rule is, going back to the turntable case, you're stuck with the choices you made at the trial court level. And if the plaintiff chose not to argue a strict liability theory, they can't complain that that wasn't used when they get to court of appeals. Ms. Keene?
So even if the trial judge made an error and not instructed during strict liability, because the plaintiff didn't ask for that in the...
Yes. It's the plaintiff's job. In other words, this, again, and a little digression here, one of the differences between the American system and the most other legal systems in the world, at least the continent of Europe, England sort of off in its own little world, mixture of, you know, common law, but most legal systems in the world put the judge in a much more directive role. The judge runs the case. In the American system, by contrast, the lawyers run the case. It's an adversarial system. They refer to, for example, the European model as an inquisitorial system. The judge, sort of representing the public, directs, even in criminal cases, takes a much more active role. The lawyers, yes, represent the clients, but the idea that you were suggesting, that the judge kind of looks out for the interests of justice and says, oh, in this case, don't you want to argue strict liability? The judge is responsible for sort of seeing to it that the justice is done. In the American system, the judge takes it much more, they sometimes refer to it as an imperial view, not an imperial, like an umpire. I'm just calling balls and strikes here. I rule on motions as they're brought. And you know, there's a lot of discussion about whether the public as a whole benefits from this highly adversarial system in which it sort of corresponds to a sort of free enterprise system as opposed to one that's sort of dominated by the government. But there are real costs to that, in part because it means if you want justice, instead of showing up at court saying, I don't need no stinking lawyer, you know, I can do this myself. It's a simple case. This guy ran into me at an intersection, cost me $800 to get my car fixed. I want my $800, please. We don't have a system that's user-friendly so that average people can walk in and get their cases heard. We rely on a system of adversarial representation. The judge is as passive, you know, the judge is the traffic cop, decides balls and strikes. But again, the notion that the judge's responsibility is to see to it that the lawyers do their job is very foreign to the American system. If the lawyer chooses not to do something, typically the judge will figure that, well, either they have some good reason for it, or I hope their malpractice insurance is paid up.
So even though the judge is like an encyclopedia of rules of law...
That overstates it somewhat. The judge, in many cases, is more knowledgeable than the lawyers, but in some cases is not, you know, and depending upon the subject matter, again, characteristic of the American system, we have omnicompetent judges. We don't specialize judges, you know, this is a judge of patent law, this is a judge of antitrust law, this is a judge of criminal law, this is a judge of, you know, if you're a superior court judge, you've got you're probating will today and you're doing a personal injury case and you've got a criminal sentencing and then you've got you're just doing case after case after case. And to expect that the judge is a walking encyclopedia of all these branches of law is unrealistic. So what we depend on is that the lawyers inform the judge, this is, you know, this is what I'm doing. And again, the judge may think the lawyer has some good reason why they're not doing that. So, again, just sort of as a digression, but it's a very important digression about figuring out the system that we have gives the lawyers a huge amount of freedom. It also puts the client essentially at the mercy of having lawyers who present all of these arguments in a suitable way, and we don't rely on judges to sort of jumpstart or supervise the process in a more active way. And as we look around the world for what that's worth, you know, there are many points at which you sort of say, well, gee, how do we compare, how does the American system compare to what they do in Germany or in Japan or in Singapore or in Australia or some other place? Well, yeah, you find some striking differences. Does that mean we're better? Does that mean we're worse? What does that mean? It's a, you know, it is an interesting question. Okay, meanwhile, back in our 5 minutes here. The Supreme Court wants this to be about strict liability. And they give us a standard. Strict liability is imposed when...
Well, in this case, when the defendant was engaged, because the defendant was engaged in a dangerously type of activity.
Okay, there's a term of art here, and the term of art turns out to be fairly important here. What's the term of art?
Abnormally dangerous activity.
Abnormally dangerous activity. And this, in fact, fits in with what Lee Sharp was saying earlier about the difference between driving a car and driving 5,000 gallons of gasoline. Driving a car is a dangerous activity, but it's not abnormally dangerous. Driving a tanker full of gasoline, 5,000 gallons of gasoline, is abnormally dangerous. Is that a difference in kind, or is it a difference in degree? Well, it's really a difference in degree, but there comes a point at which we say the difference in degree is striking enough that whereas the guy driving down, you and I driving down the highway, are held to a standard of reasonable care, and if we meet that standard, nobody can make us compensate them just because they got injured. The guy who's driving the tanker truck full of gasoline is held to a higher standard. What we tell him or her driving the tanker is, if something bad happens and this gasoline gets out and hurts somebody, you're going to pay for it. You are strictly liable for it. Now, in order for us to impose a different standard, we've got to identify what is it that triggers this higher standard. How do we know an abnormally dangerous activity when we see one?
Well, you use, like, I thought it was a subjective learned hand test rather than using numbers. They
But just in terms of, it's actually not so much, you know, going back to learned at hand, there may be some sort of balancing problem, but the key thing here is that the court is turning to this restatement. We talked before about the origin of these restatements. People who sit down, you know, at conferences and exchange drafts and try to craft this statement of the law to provide guidance to people like the Washington Supreme Court. And here the Washington Supreme Court very appreciatively picks this up and says, okay, applying the standards set forth in the restatement of torts, here is the way we're going to identify. Well, first of all, there are actually two sections of the restatement that become relevant. The first one is section 519. What does 519 say?
Chattels of another resulting from the activity, although he has exercised the utmost care to prevent such harm.
Okay, stop there. In other words, there will be a strict liability. And what does the next section of 519 say?
Point two is such strict liability is limited to the kind of harm, the risk of which makes the activity abnormally dangerous.
Okay. And those are two, you know, the first one is a little bit of a no-brainer. says there's going to be strict liability, but then it says it is limited to the abnormally dangerous character. Give me an example of a guy driving down the road in his tanker truck and causes an injury but is not held strictly liable. Mr. Redmond?
If the semi-jacked accident crushed the vehicle under
the weight. Yeah. That's not the abnormally dangerous character of driving 5,000 gallons of gasoline. He runs over a guy on a bicycle. He might be negligent in doing that, but the standard is that of reasonable care. Strict liabilities only apply to those sort of eruptions of the abnormally dangerous character, such as this one where the gasoline escapes and burns somebody. That triggers strict liability. So 519 is very important, but then 520 says, answers the question, inquiring minds want to know, well, you've talked about strict liability for abnormally dangerous activities. What is an abnormally dangerous activity? And now 520 says, here are the characteristics of an abnormally dangerous activity.
One is whether the activity involves a high degree of risk of some harm to the person and or chattels of others.
Okay, in other words, is this an activity which produces injuries on a fairly regular basis? And again, one of the things that makes gasoline such a wonderful motor fuel, it's volatile, it's highly explosive, et cetera, these are the characteristics that make it likely to erupt when your cell phone goes off and you're fueling your car or whatever. There are such cases, by the way. People standing there at the self-service gas pump, you know, with a thing like that, their cell phone goes off, the spark ignites the gas. So occasionally you'll see warnings of this. We'll talk about that later. Okay, what else?
Whether the gravity of the harm which may result from it is likely to be great.
Okay. So we're not talking about, you know, a blackberry bush that's going to cover you with scrapes and so forth. We're talking about massive incineration here. So there's a high gravity of the harm in addition to the high degree of risk. What else?
The risk can't be eliminated by reasonable care.
Again, it will reduce it. But there's a residual number of accidents that are going to occur even when reasonable care is used. What else?
The activity is not a matter of common usage.
Okay. So again, the fact that we all drive automobiles makes it difficult to characterize that as an abnormally dangerous activity. What else?
Whether the activity is inappropriate to the place where it is carried on.
And again, this has to do with a sort of safe harbor. If you've got a series of natural gas wells that are all in a sort of industrial area, that may not be strict. There may not be strict liability for that because it's appropriate to where it's being carried on. There may be other things we take into account, but whereas the tanker truck in a suburban neighborhood doesn't fit that description. Okay, what else?
The value of the activity.
Now, as we talked about earlier, when we make a list like this, we need to know whether the list is in the conjunctive. Does the plaintiff need to prove each of these in order to establish that something is subject to strict liability? Is it 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6? No. These are factors to be considered. It's not 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or 6. Any of these will trigger it. It's consider these. Roll them around for a while. See how they match up to the facts and circumstances. Then just to take this case, which of these factors do you think would count in the plaintiff's favor, which in the defendant's favor? Let's go through them here. High degree of risk. Yeah. Not common usage? That's kind of hard to say. Inappropriate locations, being carried down a highway, low social value. That winds up in the defendant's favor. Where would we be without our tankers full of gasoline? So that one definitely... Now, the court doesn't actually give you a scorecard here, but again, as you think about the, you know, applying this, for example, to somebody that's driving a tanker truck full of jet fuel as opposed to gasoline. Different characteristics of jet fuel. Not as volatile. Not as common. But again, you know, you'd have to sort of run through these criteria. What about, you know, high voltage electrical line? What about? So as you think about different things that might be subjected to this, the point is that the judge runs through these criteria, and after the judge runs through the criteria, says either as a matter of social policy, I think this activity is subject to strict liability, or I do not. Okay, we'll have to leave it at that point. Pick up with questions about this, and then we'll do Rylands versus Fletch tomorrow. We'll take a 10-minute break, come back, and do questions and answers at 11:15.